To what extent does the nuclear industry dominate the economy and the politics of the Canadian province of Saskatchewan? How severely has the University of Saskatchewan been co-opted to accommodate the nuclear agenda? How is the nuclear industry managing to co-opt three northern Saskatchewan communities to accept the contaminated nuclear waste from eastern Canada? And what kinds of obstacles are facing people in those communities who oppose this agenda? In the next hour, we will hear perspectives from Saskatoon-based retired archivist and historian Darcy Handy, as well as from an individual fighting the plan to turn her northern Saskatchewan community into a nuclear waste repository, Candace Paul of the Committee for Future Generations. On today's program, Saskatchewan's nuclear addiction contaminates both politics and the people. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 1st, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Currently, the Fed, as if America were a banana republic, which America appears to be becoming, is printing $1,000 billion per year in order to support the banks and to finance the federal deficit. This is bad news for Americans, as it means that their fiat money is being created at a far greater rate than the demand for the dollar. The implication for our future is a drop in the dollar's value. As there are no jobs, a drop in the dollar's value means high inflation on top of unemployment and double the misery of the Great Depression. As bad as this is, it is minor compared to the destruction of the planet's environment. That's from Ignored Reality is Going to Wipe Out the Human Race by Paul Craig Roberts, posted October 30th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. No one can reasonably deny that the major insurance companies were the driving force behind the writing of the Affordable Care Act legislation. The healthcare industry spent nearly $500 million lobbying for healthcare issues in 2012 and $243 million so far in 2013. Obamacare or corporate care, the writing of the Affordable Care Act sums up the process. Quote, essentially, the ACA was designed to write the for-profit healthcare system into law, increase corporate profits, and to discourage people from demanding a healthcare system that would actually provide real healthcare coverage for all. The ACA wasn't written to fix a broken system. It was written to ensure that the broken system would be kept in place. That's from Insurance Companies Profit from Obamacare by James Hall, posted October 30th, originally appearing at batr.org. How do we protect ourselves from radiation? Initially, we should reduce our exposure to radiation in the first place. Also, rain is the main way that radiation is spread outside of the vicinity of the nuclear accident. As a parent who doesn't want to tell my kids they can't play in the rain, none of this is fun to talk about. But during periods of high radiation release, people might want to keep their kids out of heavy rain. Nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson explains how to reduce exposure in case of a worst-case scenario. In a worst-case scenario, for example, if the fuel pool at Fukushima Reactor 4 were to topple over, I would close my windows, turn the air conditioner on, replace the filters frequently, damp mop, put a HEPA filter in the house, and try to avoid as much of the hot particles as possible. That's from How to Protect Yourself from Fukushima Radiation by Washington's blog, posted October 30th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
I'm speaking right now with Darcy Handy. He is a retired archivist and historian based in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And he's contributed articles to Briar Patch magazine related to the uranium industry and in Saskatchewan. And so, Darcy Handy, I'm first of all, I'd like you to help us understand the significance of the, first of all, the significance of the uranium industry in Saskatchewan. How much power it has traditionally had in terms of the its role in economic development within that province.
Well, it's actually been pretty significant. It's grown over the last 6 or 7 decades, beginning in World War II, when the Americans were about to start developing atomic bombs in the United States. Mining began in Saskatchewan for uranium. That was the primary use for it. Of course, they saw other applications for it, and it was largely under the radar screen. Nobody really paid attention to that, and I mean, who would know about nuclear energy back in the 1940s? But as time rolled along, and there was actually a Crown Corporation in Saskatchewan owned by the government that continued on with the uranium mines, selling primarily to the Americans at that time. And then it was privatized and became what that corporation and the federal government's interest in it were sold to a private company called Cameco. It was organized to buy out the Saskatchewan and federal government interests. And the uranium industry has grown apace, and it has become quite large. In fact, it's one of the primary resources that are mined in Saskatchewan, provides a lot of money to the federal or the provincial treasury through royalties, and so has become quite important and has a lot of influence here today.
Would it be accurate to say that the uranium industry is to Saskatchewan what the oil sector is to Alberta?
Well, there is oil and there is potash in Saskatchewan, and they provide significant royalties as well. But uranium is becoming, especially in northern Saskatchewan, is basically the resource that predominates as far as royalties and influence over government. And so it's, you know, I'd say it's about a third of the, you know, the three big resource. Resources, natural resources that appear in Saskatchewan that support government. So in northern Saskatchewan, that's certainly true. We've got the oil sands or the tar sands next door to us in Alberta. There are tar sands in Saskatchewan, which, oddly enough, the nuclear industry has eyed as a possible customer of nuclear energy, because it would be a way of providing energy for extracting oil from the oil sands in the future. So there has been a lot of talk, and the provincial government was actually promoting this a few years ago as to a way that we could diversify nuclear uranium usage in Saskatchewan through value added.
The general public in Saskatchewan is not quite so, doesn't seem to be quite so enthusiastic about a lot of what of what's going on with this sector, it seems to me. Could you maybe relay, I guess, what's happening with regard to, you know, recent developments in ways in which the nuclear sector seems to have advanced its interest? I understand that you've seen an acceleration in interest since the new Saskatchewan Party came to power in 2007.
Well, right. In 2007, when the Brad Wall Saskatchewan Party government was elected, part of their platform before they were elected was that they were going to promote value-added investment in the uranium-slash-nuclear industry in Saskatchewan. And as soon as they came in 2008, they appointed a panel called the Uranium Development Partnership, made up of largely industrial or corporate interests to study the issue. They issued a report, the Uranium Development Partnership issued a report in 2009 and promised public consultations. And despite the fact that there is so much investment in the uranium industry, there was a huge backlash against this whole proposal. It was to develop nuclear reactors and a nuclear center of excellence at the university. They were going to produce nuclear isotopes at a research reactor at the university. There were all sorts of things that were in this proposal from the Uranium Development Partnership, but 88% of those who responded in the public consultation were against the Uranium Development Partnership's plans for further development of the nuclear industry in Saskatchewan, which was quite a setback from a public relations perspective for the Saskatchewan Party government. But what happened then was that they actually went under the radar, and even though they said that they were going to slow down and reconsider their approach, what happened was that they actually just continued on with the partnership agenda and started promoting and developing plans for the future at the University of Saskatchewan by setting up the Canadian Center for Nuclear Innovation, it was called.
Mm-hmm. I note that you had written an extensive article on this for Briar Patch magazine, and you mentioned this article or article an initiative called Saskatchewan 2020, in which it was basically framed as a way of providing clean energy for Saskatchewan, and that nuclear power would be incorporated as one of several possible ways of bringing about clean energy, but you seem to insist that actually that's just a smokescreen, that it's essentially the driving force behind this was the development of the nuclear sector.
Oh, it definitely was, because of the huge investment that's always involved when you build nuclear reactors. They are hugely expensive. They're always at the taxpayer's expense. And so they pay lip service to wind power and solar power and other energy options as far as the power grid in Saskatchewan. But in fact, when smaller proposals come forward, like one that has just been recently proposed for near the city of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan Power, the Crown Corporation responsible for generating electricity here, always poo-poos. They give lip service to wind power, but they don't want to invest in any real way, because if they are going to go with nuclear, which is what their plan is, they cannot afford to be diversifying other energy options. You know, they're going to have to put huge investments and considering that there's only a population of 1 million people in Saskatchewan, they can't afford to be diversifying their energy options, and if they're going nuclear, that they're going to, you know, they're going to be basically jumping into the middle of it. They won't have resources for other options.
Hmm. Now, the I guess the tale of nuclear development in Saskatchewan is largely a tale of conflicts of interest and just all sorts of different influences that are being generated and then framed as somehow being in the public interest. I was wondering if you could take us through some of the ways in which we've seen these conflicts manifest itself. I think maybe an important place to start would be the University of Saskatchewan, where you've seen so much so much of the university being, contorted in order to accommodate this agenda of nuclear-fueled development.
Yeah, it's actually, when you use the word contorted, it's probably a misnomer, because it's actually happened so smoothly that I don't think people really noticed. I mean, all big corporations like to provide donations to public institutions like universities and so on. And this has been happening for the last 20 years or more in Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
There have been large donations, millions of dollars, from Cameco Corporation, which is the primary uranium company in Saskatchewan, towards the university in the form of scholarships and endowments. They've given donations for infrastructure projects like a skywalk, Cameco Skywalk, it's called, at the University Hospital. There's a Cameco Plaza. It's basically a kind of a town square that's beside the University Administration Building. These all have Cameco's name on them. And as I said, they've given the endowments over the years, so that, you know, there are many millions of dollars that have been donated to the university. Then now, they're waiting at the door to reap the harvest, because the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation is the way that they will see their research and development agenda moved forward. In fact, it's odd that back in 2005, actually, the NDP government makes about half the appointments to the University Board of Governors, and one of the people that they appointed at the time was Nancy Hopkins, a prominent lawyer in Saskatoon, but also went on the board of directors of Cameco Corporation. And as this push went forward to promote the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation, let's just call it CCNI, at the university, there were questions raised as to whether Nancy Hopkins, the chair of the Board of Governors by that time, was actually in a conflict of interest because of her promotion of the nuclear industry at the university. Being a shareholder and a member of the Board of Directors at Cameco, it certainly, the optics weren't good. When it came time for her to renew her term, the Saskatchewan Party government decided that I think she had attracted too much public attention through this conflict of interest controversy, so they replaced her. But one of the people they replaced her with was Grant Isaac, who is also on the board of directors of Cameco Corporation, and he's now on the board of governors. It seems like there's almost like a seat at the board of governors now reserved for Cameco because of their largesse over the years. Another example is the board of directors for the CCNI itself. There are 9 members of the board of directors, and 2 of those 9 are on the board of directors for Cameco Corporation as well, as well as Hitachi, which has signed a memorandum of understanding with the university and the government of Saskatchewan and they've donated $10 million towards CCNI in order to fund research and development of a small nuclear reactor prototype here at the university. There are many examples of programs at the university, colleges, departments who wrote letters of support when the CCNI was being proposed as an institute at the university. The worst example is the International Center for Northern Governance and Development here at the university. They wrote a glowing letter of support when CCNI was moving through the approval process at the university. And within days of that letter being written, that Center for Northern Governance received a $2 million grant, $1 million from Cameco, $1 million from the university, or from the government of Saskatchewan. These are the ways that Cameco and the uranium industry has exerted influence at the university, and it's really shocking when you look at what's going on behind the scenes. But the public just sees Cameco donating money to the university and sees that as a good thing, and don't look at the conditions that might be attached to those donations.
Now, how does companies like Cameco, they're also exerting their influence at the level of local communities. There's, of course, the lawsuit in which you're named as one of the plaintiffs, where in the community of Pinehouse First Nation, which is close to where they're going to be, an agreement has been put forward to become a repository for nuclear waste from Ontario.
Right.
And how is it that you're seeing these companies being able to influence decisions at the local community level?
Well, Pine House is actually a Métis village. It's incorporated under provincial legislation, but there are Pine House and the village of Creighton and the First Nation, English River First Nation in northern Saskatchewan, are three communities that are being considered as possible sites for nuclear waste repository, as you say, to bring in thousands of tons of radioactive waste from Ontario and New Brunswick and elsewhere to bury in the shield rock formations in northern Saskatchewan. These are all northern communities in Saskatchewan close to the uranium mines. And because of the colonial relationship between the provincial government and the north, where, you know, basically the uranium is deposited in the north, or that's where it's located naturally, all these resource dollars go back to the provincial government, but the provincial government does not reinvest in northern communities the way they would in southern communities. They take those resources, of course, take those royalties and use them for other purposes, leaving those northern communities still quite impoverished and therefore dependent upon in industries or the mining sector's largesse. This again is what's happening because the government of Saskatchewan has kind of frozen funding for the university. The university is forced to look into the corporate sector for financial support. The same is true with northern communities in Saskatchewan and elsewhere in the country, but we're talking about Saskatchewan here, where the government does not provide the proper levels of funding for community support. And so they are encouraged through that fact and through open speeches by Brad Wall. Brad Wall came out last December and made a speech in Prince Albert, which is kind of, it's called the gateway to the north, that Saskatchewan Party government does not need to have a program of development in northern Saskatchewan. They've got Cameco. He said that blatantly in a speech in Prince Albert in December. It was really shocking. So what's happened is that these northern communities, and Pine House is the example of the first one, has signed a collaboration agreement with the uranium industry, both Cameco and Areva, who are planning to invest more in northern Saskatchewan as a result of the new free trade agreement with the European Union, so that this collaboration agreement will provide millions of dollars to the coffers of these small northern communities, but in exchange, those communities will support the expansion of the mining industry, and if there's a nuclear waste repository that's going to be built in those communities, there are clauses in those in that collaboration agreement that will call upon the local village leadership to support the development of that nuclear waste repository. The same type of agreement has now been signed. The one for Pine House was signed in December of 2012. In May of 2013, a similar agreement was signed between the uranium industry and the English River First Nation near Beauval, Saskatchewan. And that one is even worse in that the text of that agreement at English River has not even been shared with the local community. The Indian band there has signed the agreement but will not share the text with the local community. There has been very little discussion, even though they talk about consultation and duty to consult is one of the things that is very important in Canadian law and international law. But there's a duty to consult Indigenous people about these proposals before they're actually approved. But that hasn't happened. In fact, there's been a great deal of secrecy. So, as you say, a court case has been launched by a number of people at Pine House and throughout Saskatchewan and across Canada to contest or to oppose the collaboration agreement that was signed at Pine House. And I expect there will be more coming from other communities as this juggernaut moves along.
So with all of this, we have these the provincial government so strongly invested in the uranium industry and all these other mechanisms at the University of Saskatchewan, for example, that nexus that's powering this vector of uranium development for the province. I'm wondering, like, what kind of a resistance can realistically be mustered to stop this this path that they're on?
Well, there is a group in northern Saskatchewan called the Committee for Future Generations, which has actually received awards. They received award from the Saskatchewan Environmental Network last year, or earlier this year, I should say, and at the conference of the Council of Canadians, which was just held in Saskatoon this month, they also received an activist award from the Council of Canadians. It's a very strong, locally based group which is resisting the uranium industry at all levels. They've made presentations at the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, at many, many conferences and local government meetings in the north, and they feel that the local governments and local people are starting to listen. This is, this proposal of expanding the uranium mining industry and bringing in a nuclear waste depository is going to influence or have an impact on future generations for thousands of years. The radioactive waste does not deteriorate for thousands of years. There is a great concern about people, especially among the elders and people who understand environmentalism, that this is the wrong way to go, and people are starting to listen. I couldn't guarantee that these proposals are going to be stopped. In fact, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission just approved a 10-year extension on the mining licenses in northern Saskatchewan for Cameco. So, it's a real struggle, and there is a battle out there. We're hoping that the court case that was launched at Pine House or for the village of Pine House will have an effect. We're looking at all sorts of strategies to resist this, as I call it, a juggernaut, and who knows where it'll all end up. And I don't know what will happen at the University of Saskatchewan. There are a number of members of the University Senate who have been speaking out against the way the university has become a victim of corporatization because of the freezing of government funding. We just hope that people will start to wake up to what's happening here and think through the implications.
Well, with that, I think we'll probably have to let you go. But Darcy Handy, I want to thank you very much for that analysis and helping us to better understand the whole situation there in Saskatchewan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michael.
And I've been joined by Darcy Handy, a retired archivist and historian based in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He's contributed articles to Briar Patch magazine related to the uranium industry there and is also one of the 40 plaintiffs named in a lawsuit against the Pine House Collaboration Agreement.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We welcome our new partner, CHLY 101.7 Radio Malaspina Society, broadcasting out of Nanaimo, BC, on the West Coast. The Global Research News Hour broadcasts on CHLY every Thursday, starting at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. I am now here in Saskatoon with Candace Paul. She's lived in northern Saskatchewan for nearly 30 years, married into the English River First Nation. She's been an active member of the Committee for Future Generations in their campaign to raise awareness of the real risks of the nuclear waste repository being proposed in northern Saskatchewan. So, Candace Paul, I'm very delighted to be able to speak with you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. I'm glad to.
I wanted to maybe, first of all, get you to give us a sense of the scale of the environmental aspects of this situation, you know, the concerns about this nuclear waste repository. Can you give us a bit of a primer?
Okay. The nuclear waste issue reared its ugly head. Sorry. In 2011. We found out that our band, English River First Nation, had signed up to learn more about nuclear waste. This came about in May that we found out about it. And the way I found out was there was an article, that's a, what do you call it, current events article for classrooms, with questions and answers. And in this current events thing, there was one regarding English River and Pine House and Creighton, the three Saskatchewan communities that had signed on to the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's plan for putting a nuclear waste repository in northern Saskatchewan in the Shield country. In terms of consulting the people, in 2012, they started doing open houses in the communities, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization did. And they're very wordy, which in our communities doesn't work well, because a lot of people are still coming at English as a second language. And their technical language and comprehension of technical language isn't what they're not going to be able to comprehend a lot of it.
But when you talk about an open house consultation, this is like a school gymnasium or something like that, and people are saying, hey, come to this consultation, and then the people show up and basically they're talked to?
Yeah, they have a display there. They hand out replica keychains so that the children get used to the idea of a spent fuel rod, and hand out pens that don't work. I listened to the spiel. The woman who is the Aboriginal relations person for Nuclear Waste Management Organization, we call that NUMO, because it's too long to say. So she gave me the spiel. I asked her when she was done, why would you go through all the trouble, all the expense, and all the risk of transporting that stuff all the way from Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick, across all those provinces to northern Saskatchewan, when you have the same rock formation in Ontario? She said, people of Toronto don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. That made it very clear to me, we are viewed as expendable.
Yeah, have always been.
So, from that time on, another thing I noted at that open house was one particular frame that they had up there of where they were working on convincing English River First Nation, and I'm sure they had exactly the same thing in each of these other communities, that it is our global responsibility to look after this stuff. So, you know, we'd be globally, you know, recognized for looking after this. I don't think so. I think everybody else would think you poor suckers. Because we've been doing a lot of research. That's also what the Committee for Future Generations has been doing. And we've been looking into, over the last 2.5 years, what the risks are. Because they're not talking about the risks. They say it's dangerous, but they don't really tell you what the risks are.
Do they cite any research that's been done to demonstrate that this is not going to be dangerous to your community? Or they just say, trust us?
They basically have created the whole scenario. It's their stuff that they're presenting. And no. So we've been looking, and we've come across peer reports, peers in the physics area, the nuclear physics area, the nuclear health, and physicians. And they don't all agree. They don't agree that this is going to work. In fact, this was based on a model for a repository in Sweden, and that one got sent back to the drawing board because it was proven by peers that it would not last the term of time that needs to last, which is well over 250,000 years. In fact, if you want to make sure it's safe from all of the elements, 4.7 billion years. The only thing that man has ever made that lasts that long is this stuff.
What about government's role? What are they, I mean, whatever their opinions might be as individuals, I mean, are there not obligations to have some sort of rigorous regulatory framework that you'd have to go through in order to make this go forward?
You asked that one. Okay, the federal government made it a mandate for them to get the approval of the Aboriginal peoples. That was one of the first things in their mandate, which means the intent was always to put it in First Nations territory. As far as regulatory, they have the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, who is already out doing pre-licensing presentations in the communities. One thing I have learned from doing participating in hearings on the uranium mines just recently, 3 weeks ago, was that the mining companies are pretty much setting the safety limits based on what their equipment and processes can do. So the acceptable safety limit matches that. So there's contention between the provinces and the federals in terms of there isn't an actual base of what a limit is going to be. So who's regulating what? So these recently, these omnibus bills took out environmental assessments and environmental protections on all these lakes and rivers across the country. And that is going to have an impact on what's allowed. So in terms of what the government wants, Saskatchewan Party government in 2009 had what was called the UDP hearings, Uranium Development Project. And they took their plan of having the value-added uranium development for Saskatchewan across the province to see if they could get the approval of the people. In the end, they got about 80% of the people said no to almost every aspect of their project. And so they kind of said, well, when we started out with the walk and stuff in 2011, the word was from the premier, I don't think there's a much interest in having a nuclear waste repository at this time. Since then, he's come out full tilt on his UDP plan. They are still working to develop tar sands development with nuclear power, and Saskatchewan has said no to nuclear power repeatedly over the last two decades. And this is actually this whole repository plan idea is not new for Saskatchewan. They've been working on it since 1981. So, and they've been working on getting it into the north since 1981. And part of that is because of the NAFTA agreement, they were working on a deal with the United States. We have actually, we have access to flip chart papers that were left behind by Nuclear Waste Management Organization at one of their in-house meetings at a hotel in one of the communities. And one of the things on there said, do we tell them everything now, or do we just give them bits and pieces and give them sugar-coated information? Do we tell them about the deal with the states? On there it said, the leadership will not protect the interests of the people. And a whole lot of other things. It's absolutely, we know where they're, what they're pushing, we know where they're coming from, and that is our biggest fear, is that they're talking about 2 million spent fuel rods. By the time they build the repository, it'll be 3.4 million spent fuel rods. That's in Canada. They got 104 reactors in the United States and no place to put the stuff. So, you know, they're waving the economic carrot, but we're the ones taking the risk. And when you take the risk on this, it's permanent. It's forever.
Forever dead.
Yeah.
Well, so you paint a picture where the people, by and large, don't want this, but
by and large, no. In the communities, in the community of Pinehouse, more than 60% of the people signed a petition against it. That's seen as a visible minority, according to Nuclear Waste Management Organization and the administration of Pinehouse. In English River, 373 people signed the petition against. That would mean about all of the adults in the living on reserve have signed the petition. So, no, nobody really wants this, and everybody would like to see it stopped. But there's political pressure within the communities, like big time. Administrations pretty much run the show. They have, in these small communities, they have control of jobs, they have control of houses, they have control of welfare, they have control of everything, right? So if you don't agree with them or if you speak out against them, yes, your job will disappear. That happened to me and my husband. Our jobs, our whole school program, which was a very successful school program, was completely shut down. The day after the band signed an agreement with Cameco and Areva for $604 million or something, suddenly there was no money for this school program.
So there are repercussions for speaking out when the administration, the leadership in the community decides to take the bribes?
There is. We've offered to do presentations. We brought in a scientist who is Canada's number one critic, Dr. Gordon Edwards. We brought him into the community and invited the chief and the council to come and listen. No, they didn't have time. And they went about one representative who sits on the community liaison committee for NUMO, came, stood there for 3 minutes, wouldn't sit down. And after 3 minutes, he says, "Who the hell are you? We're just trying to learn about this. We don't need you to come in here and tell us anything." This was an opportunity to learn from a scientist, a person who has studied this stuff for 30 years. And is Canada's number one go-to guy for information on whether or not anything on nuclear makes sense for an explanation. And they don't want to hear it because it threatens this little bit of money, because $23.7 billion is nothing for this. This would be a 37-year project just to get it started. And in the end, there's only going to be about 11 jobs for janitors and such, because nobody in our communities is going to have the education background to be working in that place. They won't be there for security. They won't be hired for security jobs. That's a paramilitary that's going to be being security on those sites. So, and that, because that's how they're guarded now.
It's nuclear material.
Right. And that's the other aspect. Okay, they don't want it in Toronto because it could be a target for terrorists. What about us? Thanks a lot. But that's not their real goal. Their real goal, and this is clear in the UDP hearings, and it is at the very end of their scope of things when you look at the Nuclear Waste Management Organization material. They want to be able to reprocess it. Reprocessing means you melt stuff down, dissolve it in boiling acid to get the 1% of plutonium that's in it. What you're left with is radioactive acidic sludge. Now, they do this in France, and in France, they use 40% of their fresh water for this.
Are you suggesting that what they're doing in France, they're going to be doing at or near these?
And they want to reprocess, and they want to be able to get more of the energy out of this stuff.
Would they be reprocessed on site, or would they be moving it to another location?
They'd be trying to do this all in Saskatchewan. This is what our premier has been aiming for. They need a lot of water. So northern Saskatchewan is a sponge. It's all water. And this is the other issue we have with the whole repository plan is because of the water. It's above ground. It's below ground. They say they're going to put it 500 meters down within a stable rock formation, but no rock is stable after you've blasted holes in it or drilled holes in it. And plus, there's always water. I mean, they're having difficulty opening the Cigar Lake mine because it keeps flooding on them from the water pressure within the rock itself. So you fissure that a little bit and you're going to have a problem. Now, this stuff, once it sits there, like when they bring it, it would be hot, still physically hot, not just radioactive hot, but physically hot. And as it decays, it continues to heat, and that heat builds. So, for instance, when you have a candle in a room, you have light, right? You put 2 million of these things in a chamber below ground. That's going to throw off a hell of a lot of heat. Now, you heat rock, add water. You got fractured rock all over the place. And these containment systems, one of the real big studies that was done on it said that unless the material they use has absolutely no flaws, there is going to be a problem at some point. And if there becomes a problem with this stuff, this is a radioactive explosion. And one of the questions that was asked at the CNSC presentation on pre-licensing within our band, because I was able to get to that meeting because I actually heard about it through the grapevine that it was happening. And I took off from work and I went.
How much notice did you have?
An hour. And while we were there, and when we walked in and said why we were there, because one of the things my husband was told is that by elders was regarding anything to do with uranium and nuclear, you have to monitor these people. Anybody who makes big bullets, meaning bombs, need to be monitored. So he was telling them that, and they called the cops on us. We did not leave, and the cops didn't do anything, but just the fact that they called cops on us made it very clear that they don't want anybody there that's going to question people. But we stayed, and we did question. But I didn't ask this question. One of the other people there asked the question, and that was they wanted to know the answer to tell them, give them something to compare the difference between the radiation spread and exposure of the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombs to the Chernobyl incident. The guy from the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission talked for about 5 minutes, never answered the man's question. The only thing he said of real import in that 5 minutes was that they used the Japanese people to find out about what radiation will do to people. So,
you mean
they learned from that experience about radiation exposure. That was the only thing. And finally I said, will you please answer the man's question? And I rephrased the question. I said, he wants to know the difference between the spread of radiation and how much radiation between Hiroshima and Chernobyl. Please just answer that. He finally says, I don't know. Well, I'd done research on it. So I said, I'll tell you, because I've done the research, which you all should have done by now. You've been working on this for 2 years, and you haven't done the research to know whether or not these guys know what they're talking about and whether you should believe them or not. The difference is, I'll just tell you, yes, everybody was affected by the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs. There was radioactive spread across the world, but the major import of it was in Japan. Chernobyl, on the other hand, that one spread to an area equivalent to northern Saskatchewan, northern Manitoba, northern Alberta, southern Nunavut, southern Northwest Territories. That was just a drop in the bucket compared to what they're talking about bringing here. Something goes wrong. Well, yeah, we're the first ones to go, but everybody else is not far behind. The idea, the whole concept of putting all of this stuff in one place is totally bizarre. It's just insane. It should never all be put in one place. Okay? Just because in case one goes wrong, then you're not going to have to deal with all of it. So what we've become aware of is, in order to stop the whole concept, we need to stop producing nuclear waste. If they thought when they started this that they'd have an answer by now. They are nowhere close. They haven't got a clue how they're ever going to deal with this radioactive problem. And what's going on in the world with what's going on in Japan, which most of the world isn't hearing about because they don't want them to know. They compare that disaster to between a car accident and an airplane crash. Well, except airplane crashes affect the people on the plane. They do not, and the families of those people. They don't affect every living thing on the planet. And that's what's beginning to happen with what's going on with this radioactive problem that they've created, that they want to drop on our doorstep. So the problem's become grander than just our region. It's a global issue. It really needs to be dealt with globally. One of the things we're really working on right now is developing a health study, our own health study. We want an independent one. We know we're not going to get one. At the CNSC hearings, the medical health officer for Northern Saskatchewan said we didn't need one. He only wanted one for mental health and well-being. Because they asked him if you had a wish list.
The provincial health officer said this?
Yeah, the provincial Northern medical health officer, Dr. James Irving, said that. They asked him if he had a wish list, what kind of study would he ask for? We want to get independent labs because we can't trust our provincial lab. It just can't be done because other people have sent in fish for sampling. Inconclusive results. Inconclusive results. So it's very expensive to get this done and get it done right. We've got our own Geiger counters now. And we're going to be learning the proper way to use them so that we can test areas ourselves to make sure they're not contaminated. We're also getting reports from miners, even though they're not supposed to talk. They're not supposed to talk about what they see in those mining areas.
Like a confidentiality agreement?
Confidentiality agreements, a.k.a. gag order. But it bothers them in their heart that they're out there burying radioactive stuff, contaminated material, in a muskeg. A muskeg is a swamp where the water it used to be the cleanest water in the world because it was filtered through all these plants, but not anymore. There's completely dead rivers and streams. The uranium industry says when they're developing this one new mine called the Millennium Mine, that the effluent coming out will be less than severely contaminated. What does that say? That says it's contaminated. And, you know, oh, well, it doesn't have to make drinking water standards. Well, wait, the food we eat and drink.
And bathe in.
Bathe in all comes from that. And you're telling us it's going to be okay. And yet you won't go out there and drink it. I get reports from people they wouldn't touch the stuff coming out that pipe if, no way. Anybody in this transportation route of this can be also affected by the radiation from those transports. The transport hasn't actually been tested with actual real radioactive waste in it because they said that was too dangerous. Transportation route could be anywhere because they will not transport it on the same route two times in a row. You won't know when it's being transported, so you won't be told to stay off the road. In the United States, they expect that there will be cancer deaths attributed to the transportation of nuclear waste. So if it's expected in the United States, you can expect it in Canada too. I found that most of the other countries dealing with nuclear are a little bit more open about it than Canada is, and that our limits are a bit higher than what's acceptable limits in other countries. So I don't know. I think everybody's at risk. I think this stuff needs to be maintained where it is and with rolling stewardship. And I think we need to really seriously look at not producing it anymore. There are tons of alternatives and more alternatives being developed all the time for energy. If that's the only thing you're worried about is having enough energy, well, first of all, in Canada, they don't even need nuclear power. They export, practically give away, because they produce too much energy and they have to get rid of it off the grid. So they give it away at cost to the United States. 33% of our energy produced in Canada goes to the U.S. 15% is of energy produced in Canada is from coal. Another 15% is from nuclear. So do we need a nuclear industry? No. We don't.
Except to sell.
They're not making any money from it. They have to give it away or it would ruin their grid. So, you know, it's basically for the manufacturing community in Ontario. That's all they got it for. And now this government wants to put it in the tar sands up here. Nuclear and tar sands. We're getting set up to become a sacrifice zone. We really are. And we don't deserve that.
That concludes our show. For more background on the topics aired today, be sure to check out Darcy Handy's articles at BriarPatchMagazine.com, as well as the website for the Committee for Future Generations at committeeforfuturegenerations.wordpress.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.